Now, one of the best things to do with a weapon that you don't know what to do with would be to park it someplace and forget about it and get a weapon that you did know what to do with. Wouldn't that seem sensible? Yeah, but this is a problem that's being handled by government. Now, why can't you walk in to a large business corporation? Why can't you walk into a government? Why can't you walk in to Mr. Big and say to him, I have a solution to your difficulties? Now look, at the moment, you can take my word for it, although there are a few of you sitting right now in the audience who have been through the HCC very recently, who were dragging through as cases as long as Dianetics is old, as long as Scientology has been going. The cases never quite came up to expectancy. They expected more to happen than it happened. And now they know that something has happened to their cases, and they have advanced. They know that an advance has taken place, and there are several people sitting right amongst you this morning who would tell you that. We have a big weapon. It's probably the biggest weapon on Earth at the moment, because it is a weapon and it can be used. And if there is another weapon on Earth that is tremendously big, a huge weapon that can't be used, who's left with a weapon? All right. The atom bomb is a solution to all man's problems everywhere. But no problems. So it's too big a solution, isn't it? Well, man gets solutions mixed up with violence, death, and the end of it all. And he begins to avoid solutions. So that you walk into a big business corporation and you say, look, I can make all of your employees 50% more efficient. I can even bring you up to a point where you know what office you're sitting in. And what's he saying? He said, well, I don't know, I'll take it off, put somebody on. First manifestation is that the man has to have problems. He has to have problems because he doesn't dare arrive. He doesn't dare arrive because he knows it's painful. In other words, he realizes you're trying to put him in a no-game condition, he thinks. Man has identified going into a no-game condition, such as dead, with putting himself into a position where he can play a game. These things are harmonics on the same thing. Man can play a game here. He can be serene, but he can play a game. He can be nameless, but he can have an identity. He can be good, but he doesn't have to be good. He can win, he can lose, but he doesn't have to, and it isn't the end all of existence if he does either. Then a man can have a game. Have you ever tried to play a game with your, have you ever tried to play a game of blackjack to get screwed with your last dollar? That's not a game, that's desperation. And here he believes himself to be playing a game of such seriousness that he cannot afford to play the game at all. It isn't a game anymore. Life is therefore not interesting. Life is not something that is to be lived. Life is not something which is to be used to live with. And he immediately believes then that he had better sort of grind away at something he's certain about and leave all this foolishness alone, because life is serious and life is real. And the death is its goal or something. And he falls completely out of any real interest or livingness. He's playing blackjack with his last dollar. Always, he believes. And therefore, he can't have a solution. The solution is down here. Solution means end of game, end of action, and end of doingness. And he knows what that is. End of doingness is painful. It's agony. It's all there is gone. It's total loss. That's a solution to him. You say you have 12 stenographers here, and you have three of them who are actually doing the correspondence, and the other nine actually walk back and forth and originate communications to each other. Only they get so much in the road that the other three can't do the correspondence they're supposed to do. Now, the solution is to find some work of the organization for these remaining nine girls and put them in the places on fixed communication lines where they really can contribute to the situation. In other words, let's straighten out these communication lines. It seems to be the most reasonable thing you can think of. You walk in, tell him this. What are you trying to do? Sort of throw this bum out, sort of an attitude. You're just trying to mess us up, that's all. How would he be messed up? Because a game called confused secretarial directionalism would be an end. That would be the end of a game. And he's got this mixed up with pain and agony. And he knows, reactively, what would happen to him if he actually did straighten out his secretaries. He knows what would happen to him. He'd be in agony. He'd be broke. It would be the end of existence. In other words, he's playing this game called business with the same desperation that somebody tries to avoid an avalanche which is falling on him. And you have threatened to hit him with one pebble. And he knows that one pebble is followed by the mountain. What can you sell him? Just telling you this to show you a little of the gold that falls out of this theory of games. It tells you what he'll buy. He'll buy a game condition. What's a game condition? Confusion. Motion. Problems. Difficulties. Getting stuck in things. Going to jail. These are game conditions. So you walk in. He has nine secretaries that merely swap notes to get in the road of the other three secretaries and so forth. You persuade him to hire three more. You make up some forms for them to make out that report on the remaining nine. And they have to survey each one of the reports and add to it, and this takes up their whole day. He buys this. And actually some work comes out of the office. Why? You covertly nailed down nine secretaries who were being random by making them make out too many reports, you see? You actually can use this sort of thing. Now, I'll give you another example of this. Give me another example of this. You have this big department, and this department is in charge of waterworks and rivers and harbors and stuff. And this big outfit is all involved with paper chains, and you appoint people so that you can relieve people, so that that ends that communication line. But not positively, there still is a confusion at each end. They have their desks so fixed that the reports on the water levels all wind up in the accounting department, so that they have to be misrouted because accounting doesn't know anything about that. And they've got these things going round and round, and you see this horrible confusion. One of the first things you could do to straighten it out from yourself would be to look for a stable datum somewhere in it, something that is still motionless or stopped. That would be the beginning of your workout of this confusion. And then, because you've got to sell a lot of people who know that to solve anything is to die, you really fix them up. You say, what you should do now, look the situation over carefully. You've always been worrying about floods. You've always been worrying about floods. You've said if you put up enough waterworks and dams and so on that you'd have these floods, you'd have these floods under check. They've never done this. You know, the floods just keep rolling down, taking cities away and smash up the countryside and carry away all the farms and tops on everything. You said, now, we're supposed to stop all these floods. They've just said, confusion, confusion, confusion. You said, now, stopping those floods, you've always thought of as a problem. Man, you haven't got a problem even vaguely in that compared to this other problem. Wow! The problem of drought. Now, the truth of the matter is you will have to flood all kinds of valleys and surrounding countryside and so forth in case there's a drought. Never has been a drought. Never has been one. You would be amazed. Sensible men at this time, you say to yourself, they say they look right through this, you know, and they say, there's never been any droughts in this area, and we don't have to store any water. Our trouble is to get rid of the darn stuff. That's what they'd say. But you have estimated the organization as a sensible organization. You believe that it depends on good reasoning, and it follows out its goals, and that's what it does. It's a sensible organization. It isn't. It doesn't intend to, not even vaguely. But you come along and you want to actually put them into the business of stopping floods so that you can save some of the farmland that's being swept away in some of the cities. All right, that's what you do. You say it's this big problem of drought. Have you ever handled this problem? Have you ever realized what it meant to have all... Well, think of it, the Mississippi without a drop of water in its bottom. You'll be surprised. Fellows will sit there and they'll say, that's pretty terrible. You say, but the problem of trying to find enough valleys and to build enough dams to store this water is insurmountable. Just building dams to keep Mississippi in check, that's nothing. But just think of trying to think of the horrible legal consequences of seizing land, seizing farms, confiscating property. Why, you just be in violation of the Constitution and the Bill of Rights and everything else, and the legal work involved in it's terrific. You'll have to add 8 legal departments just to take care of the confusion of kicking people out of these valleys so that you can flood them. And that's a problem. How are you ever going to get over that? They figure, and they worry, and they work, and everything starts going more confused. And while they're not watching, the actual machinery of stopping the floods goes back into action. Why? They've got a bigger problem so they can afford a solution to a little problem. Now, nations and organizations and individuals actually work on this principle. Any of you have run problem of comparable magnitude too? Well, know that. We say to somebody, give me a problem of comparable magnitude to your mother. There are very specific ways of running it. Problem of comparable magnitude to your father. Problem of comparable magnitude to your grandfather. Problem of comparable magnitude to your name. Anything you want, say. And the fellow all of a sudden comes unfixed off this problem and looks over and sees a bigger problem. Then you give him a bigger problem, you fix his attention on the second one, you put it over here on the third. And gradually, he's perfectly willing to solve this problem over here. Quite interesting mechanism. But it works on big organizations. Now, if you were to go into a big organization, you want to become a great success. You want to be a big success? Don't go around solving their difficulties. Boy, they'll hate you. They look at you like you're a murderer. You're about to kill them. Get out of here with those solutions. We know it's reasonable to file everything that begins with A under A, but we don't do it that way. The thing for you to do is to figure out a more complicated filing system than they already have. A more complicated paper chain than they already have. Figure out more forms to be filled in and to go more places, to bother more people. Make enough confusions here or there to a point where you're elected to chairman of the board. This man's a good man. Now, some of you are working with corporations, recognize the truth in what I'm saying, but you think I'm joking. You don't think these outfits would buy that. They would. They'd buy it. You go in and you say, I have a way to cut out form 82, 85, and 86 by combining it in the original form number one. They say, I'm very sorry today. I'm very busy. You will have to talk to somebody else about this. You go in and you say, you know, form number 1, 85, 86, 97, and 102 are inadequate. I can't make out my reports with this little data. We've got to originate another form, which I've typed up here, which gives us the relative birth rates of the office employees. And this has to be added in for cross-analysis. We'll call these form 150, 151, 152, and 153, in addition to the existing forms. Then we'll have it. You'd be surprised. Mr. Big ordinarily open those doors. He'll say, son, you have a future. Most organizations solve their problems by increasing the number of identities on their payrolls. More identity is a game condition. They have very great difficulties. They just can't get in touch with New York or keep New York straight. So instead of analyzing the communication lines to New York, what the Chicago office does is hire 5 more people to pound New York. Change the New York manager, put in some guy that they know will flop, and then hire 12 more guys in New York who are supposed to maintain communication with Chicago. This doesn't work, so they hire 10 more people in Chicago and 10 more people in New York. This doesn't work, so they buy a new building in New York just to house the employees in order to communicate with Chicago, where they have to buy a new building to file the messages. 2 outfits still aren't working, and thus General Electric is born. Every time you add identities into a situation, you're all right. Now, you have to have some identities present in order to have a game condition. You wouldn't have any communication lines or any business at all unless there were some identities involved. See? But there gets to be too good of a thing there along the line someplace, and you have so many identities involved that nothing could be done. Well, I'll tell you something amusing that happened in the HASI London. Something very, very amusing. Something that you laugh at it because it happens in a central office of Scientology. We had a great many business people who had been hired. One of them, an office manager, and he was doing all right. But we had a lot of clerical help that had been hired straight out of the market, the labor market of London. And we brought this these clerical people on and so on. And we found out that work was doing a little bit worse than it was. So they hired over there some more people to expedite it. First thing you know, the payroll was getting astronomic, and the bank balances of the organization were dropping and so on. And so the association secretary and I went to the mat about this, and we worked out a budget. And I pushed the budget down into an extremity, which was to be within the income of the organization, which seems rather a reasonable thing to do. Because I had altitude and did it with auditing procedure, he bought it. And put it into effect with great difficulty, but we got it in effect. We got it into effect. He's actually a real good boy. He was aware of this principle, too. We got to laughing about this because we did something terribly arbitrary. We merely removed all personnel exterior Scientology from the office without any regard whatsoever for their functions. Obviously, this would have left terrible holes in the organization. By all planning known to man, this would have been a terribly desperate step to have taken. And so it was a desperate step. It was in effect for 2 days. Those people had been missing for 2 days. And all of a sudden, the office manager came to me and he says, "You know, something odd is happening, Ron. Everybody is getting work done. The organization is running more quietly and smoothly than I've ever seen it run before. What's happened?" Well, what's happened is that the clerical staff that was hired was just following standard business routines. And they were originating enough communications so that other communications could be answered to those, and they were taking in their own washing. And this would have been perfectly all right if they hadn't disturbed the Scientology personnel working on the job and their own business manager. But so happened that we disturbed they disturbed the Scientologists on the job and the bankroll and the accounts, and when they were removed from the situation, all of those extraneous communications were removed from the situations, and we uncovered two or three Scientologists who were also working on clerical staff who up to this time had been completely snarled up continually trying to keep the other communication lines unsnarled, which were always snarled. And the operation at half the payroll was suddenly getting along with beautiful smoothness. Now, that's a terrible argument. No labor union would buy this argument. So in order to sell that, you have to give somebody a bigger problem. All right, let's put that same kind of an incident on a national basis. You interested in a third dynamic application of games?
Yeah.
All right, let's put this on a national basis. Let's put it on a labor union basis. We tell the labor union flatly that if they got rid in industry and factories and that sort of thing, if they got rid about three quarters of the people they had employed, they'd be able to get something done. And we get their agreement on anything. No. Now, they'd only agree with us if we guaranteed to hire two more for every one they've got on. The trouble is already that every post has got too many communication lines mixed up in it. Work isn't necessarily accomplished by numbers. Somebody said many hands make light work. I just reduce this to many hands make work. And carry it further to many hands make work work. See, a few of us have run organizations and that sort of thing in this when we were all wearing all hats. Taking it in from all directions, and actually the field and public at large got more service during those times, even if things were more hectic than at any other time. Well, how would we do something like this? We would take a national level. We'd do something weird. We would hand out a problem to industry and government, which was so close to unsolvable that they would be willing to reduce their personnel. How would we do that? And still not upset the wage earner and the amount of pay he was getting. How would we do that? Well, we could advance a Scientology principle. We could say people interiorize into their work and become inefficient. And becoming inefficient, interiorized into their drill presses and books and so forth, and becoming much, much too pinned down and introverted, are therefore and thereafter liable to riot, commotion, disturbance, agitation. They fall for labor agitation. They strike. They cost us lots of money and so forth. Why? Because the people have actually slightly gone mad. They've been interiorized until they no longer see further than the ends of their noses. They don't see the health of the organization. They don't see the health of the factory or the corporation or the government. They only see the little gadget they've got right in front of their face. So they look at this little tiny thing and they get interiorized into that. Somebody comes along and says, "You're being done in. Everybody's doing you dirt. Strike. Workers of the world, arise. Workers of the world, go to bed." Whatever it is. Oh, I'm sorry, that's Freudian. But anyhow, we give them this as an explanation because it's true, you see. It's perfectly true. And we advance as a reality a single process which is very workable. We say when a worker is tired and exhausted and he's only been doing clerical work or that sort of thing, you know that if you send him out and make him walk around the block until he's actually looking at the environment, give him havingness, walk around the block until he's interested in the environment, that he will stop worrying and being obsessed with the materials he was handling. That's terrifically good therapy. It's very simple. We simply say to somebody, "Go take a walk around the block." Tell you how I evolved that. It's a process. I'm writing a little book called Security in the Workaday World, which is to go out with the PE courses. People come in, they want to know about work. We talk about principles of Scientology, put them into the framework of how you work. And this little book then had to have a couple of packed solutions. And one of those solutions had to be on the first dynamic, and one, of course, had to be on the third. How do we extrovert a worker? How do we keep him from spinning in by being too pinned down to his job? Well, we had to have something simple that would work without an auditor present. So we had him walking around the block until he extroverted. I've told several people about this. They do now. They walk around the block until they're not tired. It's very funny, but they can walk around the block until they're not tired. If they only walk around the block far enough to get tired and then quit, they've just re-stimulated themselves. You have to keep on walking around the block. Of course, you could probably walk yourself clear walking around the block. Now, how would we ever sell a third dynamic solution of this character? How would we ever make the third dynamic alert to this? We'd have to give them a bigger problem, wouldn't we? We just like we have to give the pre-clear a bigger problem to get him off his fixation on how terrible it is that all Ford cars cough at him when he walks by them. We actually have to teach him on the third dynamic that there is a bigger difficulty. The horrible difficulties of government job planning. It's just terrible, the difficulties of government job planning. The government has never been efficient, and to let them do this at all is almost completely disastrous. But somehow or other, with great watchfulness, we will make sure that they do a good job of this. They say, "What's job planning got to do this?" You say, "You're going to keep people working in automobile industry 8 hours a day. They drive home, they sit down in front of a television set. They go to bed, they get up in the morning, they work 8 hours in their office or at their drill press. Ah, what gives? Guy's going to introvert, he's going to get tireder and tireder and tireder. His job is going to be done less well and less well and less well. He's going to be more and more liable to strikes and agitation. It's going to take more and more force and duress and persuasion to get him to work at all. He's going to pull blunders. What's the solution? I'm afraid that you better take 4 hours of that man's 8 and have him spend them outside on civic or construction programs." Everybody says, "You mean double the number of people that will be working in the factory?
How horrible. We will have twice as many people working here. That's right. Morning shift, afternoon shift. Oh, they say, think of the books. Yeah, think of the accounting problem. Think of the tax problem involved to supporting that many civic projects. Think of the difficulties you'll have with politicians trying to keep their hands out of the pork barrel while they're building all these things. You make it practically against the law for a fellow to work at an introverted job unless he has an extroverted one. You say it's very difficult. How are you ever going to sell to the public the idea that you should permit an executive and enforce an executive, not just permit, but enforce an executive to go fishing 6 times a week? Well, because part of game condition is kicking the other fellow out of the game. This is one of those nice, smooth, workable solutions. Why is it workable? Because it's so idiotic. But it would do exactly what we know, if we look it over, we will know, would have to be done in order to bring sanity into industry and labor and government worker relations. You can't keep the man in the office 24 hours a day and expect him to stay up and do otherwise than to get old and crickety and inefficient and upset. If you're going to have a vital nation, you have to have vital people. We'd start in on some sort of a thing if you're going to carry out a program like this, just an example. There is a problem today in the schools. Let's just go over into this. I'm going to cover, just notice as we're going by that I'm covering some of the titles that you have in your... In schools, we notice that children have a difficult time learning anything. The end product of modern education is a child being able to arrive at the age of 12 without being able to write, read, spell, or even get to school. That's evidently the end product. I know I used to do traveling ovals and all of that sort of thing, and by the hour, and used to slave away and work and labor in order to learn how to write. And I did all that work on the subject, and people can't read my writing worth a nickel even today, you see. So now we give a fellow 1/8 that amount of training, and he writes 8 times as bad. Or maybe we train him sensibly, and he really learns how to write. I've opened up some old books from way back when. Minutes. One of them here that I ran into, I've been a member of many of the societies, by the way, and organizations here in Washington, D.C., and as an officer, very often your accounts and so on, or your minute books, will extend back a considerable length of time. And the Columbian Society, for instance, goes back to about 1821, and its first minutes are its formation, and contain a speech by the Marquis of Lafayette, which was given at the banquet. He was over here at that time. You ought to see the penmanship. Perfect copper plate, ornamented beautifully. And I ran into a fellow one day who could write like this. And I said, how did you ever learn to write like this? He said, I don't know. Isn't that the way you write? But down through the years, we discover that the writing in these minutes is deteriorating. By 1870, to make a C, you merely make 5 or 6 curly Q's. Not like 1830, where you practically drew pictures of everything under the sun to make a C. Different. But you see this writing deteriorating right on up now. My handwriting in these books, I assure you, doesn't add to their artistic abilities. Although people say my handwriting is quite forceful, I'm very proud of that, if they didn't add the fact that it's seldom readable. Somebody, a calligraphist, once accused me of having achieved an ultimate in artistic presence and complete undecipherability. I thought it was quite a compliment. Put me in a no-game condition right there. Well, anyway, we see that the earlier student did something the later student doesn't do. It doesn't have to do with mechanics and it doesn't have to do with machines. Let's just knock out the idea that having some machines, to having some electric lights, having a little entertainment around, something like that, would do much to a society. You see, it's not a very aberrative factor. It's a very mildly aberrative factor, but it only re-stimulator of some sort. Now, it isn't that kind of thing which makes men mad. If you denied men the bulk of the solids they were used to, if you made them stay indoors when they should be outdoors, you would see a deterioration in their character. You would reduce their habits. Does that make sense to you? In other words, the old-timer spent most of his time out in the park or riding around. There wasn't anything to do inside anyhow. You didn't have much in the way of electric lights. You just had a candle and they were expensive and so on. But he managed to do things at night, I'm told. I remember. Anyhow, he got outside. He was able to live in the world, not in a house or an office or at the plain table of a machine. He lived in the world. The world consisted of fields and valleys and rivers and mountains. That was the world. It consisted of rather boisterous weather. It consisted of a lot of things. He had havings. He had solid objects. He had not yet learned to be afraid of them. And therefore, he could solve things. He could write things like the Constitution, the Declaration of Independence, without a qualm. Didn't upset him at all. And he could then afford, when he did spend some time working on something, to really work at it, not work at working at it. He could learn fast. His havingness was up because he had the whole wide world, as much of the whole wide world as he could look at within a lot of walking in any direction. He had more world than the airline pilot who was skipping back and forth between London and New York. That fellow doesn't have world, he has distances. Now, if this is a salient factor, it might apply to education in a very interesting way. Supposing we had a classroom in which a child had to spend 5, 6, 7 hours a day grinding away, and he never got outside, we would suppose that with that much study he'd learn something. But we see by experience that the more time he spends inside, evidently, over a certain ratio, the less he learns. There's something wrong here, then, with education. What could be right with education? Supposing you did this. Supposing you said, you see, they have a lot of problems. See, you couldn't be able to do anything about this, but supposing you said this. For every hour a child spent at a school desk and in a schoolroom, he had to spend an hour on the athletic field under coached athletics, which really were athletics. Not, here's a ball, boys, you play volleyball for 15 minutes while I go over here and talk to Miss Brown, who's just been appointed staff. I mean, real athletics, flat out. They have a lot of problems in education right now. They have so many problems they might even be willing to be rid of a few of them. That's adventurous to say, but you certainly could make them get rid of them if you introduce some new problems. You said, now, you're worrying about hiring teachers. You say that we are understaffed. We don't have enough teachers, and you're worried about having teachers. You silly people. Hiring teachers, how are you going to hire as many athletic coaches as you have teachers? And they'd say, duh. As many athletic coaches. What do you want athletic coaches for? Well, you've got to get the children outside on the athletic field. Don't you know the latest theory of creative education? But a child must have guided exercise before it can learn. How are you going to hire this many coaches? But you're just wasting time. How are we going to hire this many coaches? Well, I guess there'd be this many bachelors of arts that have found out nobody wanted their ticket. So that they would be willing to come in and to be athletic coaches, because they don't want to be in classrooms. They're allergic to those, but they might like to come in and coach children. Oh, yes. You say, well, they'd say, that's a pretty harsh problem. We probably could solve that. Oh, don't let them do that. You say, well, I'm not talking about that problem. How are we going to get enough appropriation to build this many gymnasiums to take place of athletic fields during winter time? How are we going to get enough money to do that? Wow. And they'd say, gee, that is a tough one. Gee, how would you get people to believe this in the first place? How would you do this? Oh, my. Oh, that's pretty rough. Gee, that's a tough... Well, I'll call the committee together and we'll take this up to see how we can get enough coaches and get enough gymnasiums. But I really don't know how they'll go for this. You've done it. Don't ever discuss your program. It's a solution. As long as you make a solution in to a nearly insurmountable, let's advise it, problem, you can sell it. You can always sell a solution if it creates a nearly insurmountable problem in somebody's mind. You see how you could sell a solution on the third dynamic? All right, you wonder why this garage man down here hasn't ever put in a proper hydraulic lift. He's still using some sort of a pit, and he's having an awful time with this pit and so on. Do you realize that if you told him they were having an awful lot of trouble with hydraulic lifts lately and he probably shouldn't get one, that he probably would acquire one? The entrance to the trap is curiosity. And to a garage man, the entrance to having this is repair. You tell him, you could explain to him a lot of things about it. He'd still go on and get a hydraulic lift for some reason or other. Actually, he uses pits. There isn't any difficulty with these pits. You just walk down in them, you drive the car over them, cars seldom fall into them. Nothing really happens with regard to pits. The machinery, you know, they don't leak. They're simple, easy to handle. You could actually get him to abandon that nice solution by telling him how difficult it was to repair these new hydraulic lifts. You could keep crabbing about him and he'd all of a sudden snap terminals with you. You'd come up one day and somebody at Lord knows what expense would be installing one in his garage. Well, that is just a goofy way to use this sort of thing because there would be no real point in it. But supposing you really wanted children educated. If you want them educated, you're going to have to furnish them an extroversion factor adequate to the introversion factor attempted by education. You're going to have to give them enough time outside and under HC to unspin them out of their old educational programs. You know, every one of you has probably had to learn arithmetic about 25 or 30 times in the last few centuries. Don't you get tired of it? Funny part of it is, if you gave a fellow, a little girl, a little boy enough HC, he probably would come up and do arithmetic. I've had him do that. I have some processes worked out now, actually, to turn a fellow speaking Arabic. You know these spiritualist things? They used to, every once in a while in a seance, somebody starts speaking perfectly good Amharic or something, whatever language that is. You know, they weird tongues, and somebody listened to it, and they'd say, hey, what do you know? He's speaking Lower Nile blah, blah. I wonder how come he'd do that. Well, actually, you merely put him in control of the objects connected with the language in some former existence, and he will be able to have the language again. He can't have the language in absence of the objects. You can't have arithmetic in absence of the school where you learned it. That's why people always forget their education afterwards. It's very simple. Unless you give them enough havingness, in connection with an education, they haven't got one. What are we going to do? Go on for the rest of our lives and generations in this country with juvenile delinquency and crime and half-educated kids? And is the handwriting going to get so bad that they consider the requisite for a high school graduation certificate will be to be able to write the alphabet in a plain hand, given 4 or 5 hours for the examination? Is that the final course of this sort of thing? You actually could give him enough havingness as a student to disinterpolate him. Well, now, theoretically, you could give him enough havingness as a student to make him remember what he knew already. Now, this would be quite an interesting program. That'd be an interesting educational program, wouldn't it? You just made it so that everybody who was being educated had to have so much time doing athletics. It'd be an interesting thing. Although athletic programs, I see, that you and I have known have not been successful programs. That's because they weren't athletic programs. They were standing around programs. They were, if I have to put this sweatshirt on just one more time, I will scream sort of programs. No coaches, no equipment, no arrangement, so on. Now, where do we get, where would we enter this problem for its solution? That's just as an example. Where would we enter this problem for its solution? We would enter it by adding problems. We'd add to the problem. We would show people that they really weren't doing a good job of realizing how many problems they did have. Now, we could probably sell an employer the idea of giving nursery work to working children, working parents. Very important. You know, the whole world is working these days. A marriage is that union between man and woman which permits them both to get paychecks. It really has nothing whatsoever to do with marriage as it existed once. The price of living has gotten such that man and woman both have to work if they really are going to make a wide swath on it, and women find this out. It's actually true today that the girl who marries in order to be supported supports. This idea of getting married as a profession is very difficult. All right, children come along, and that becomes then an economic difficulty of great magnitude. The more difficult it begins to be, I'm afraid, the more children there will be, though. Nevertheless, for a healthy future generation, it would be necessary for somebody such as us to advocate some sort of a program that made it necessary that if you were going to hire people up above a certain number, you had to contribute a small amount of money to a nursery fund. And you had to maintain nurseries around town that were really good nurseries so the children simply wouldn't be abandoned and forgotten, kicked overboard, just on the basis of the fact that people worked. Get the idea? But if you wanted to put a solution like that into effect, how in the name of common sense could you do it without adding to the problem? You have to add to the problem to get the solution bought. You'd have to say, how on earth are we ever going to get enough pickup trucks to pick up all these kids every morning to have citywide nursery systems? How are we going to guarantee that these kids aren't just going to be abandoned in the nurseries themselves? How are we going to guarantee that they're going to be perfectly happy about it? How can we get a system like this worked out? How are we possibly going to get employers to contribute a small amount of money for each one of their employees in order to support such a nursery system through the city? Now, these are problems. And the trick of the matter, working out this situation on the third dynamic, is a very simple one. It's an extremely simple one. All you do is yourself know the solution and advance to the pre-clear problems. You advance enough problems till he comes, and in such a way that he comes up with your solution. And this will work definitely on the third dynamic, most observably on the third dynamic. It'll work very well in auditing. Well, you've always wondered how to sell a corporation the idea of Scientology. You've gone in and said this will all be very simple, it works out very easily, it'll increase your efficiency, it'll do away with a lot of your difficulties. You see at once that this makes some sense to you, huh? All right, let's go in and say, look, I don't know how we can give you Scientology and its assistance in this plant. You don't have any facilities. You say, you don't have the proper kinds of group rooms. There's no testing rooms. Our testing rooms and so forth are clear on the other side of town, and there's no transportation to them. How are we going to utilize some of your space here, no matter how poorly, in order to carry out a proper program? This is very difficult. Now, I'd show you the results of this, except you have to write a letter notarized as to your actual position with the organization to a certain organization back east that has these, and a set of them cost $12. And they can only take money orders. you want the material that tells you how good this is. Well, there's the way you get it. Problems, problems, problems. They won't even go up against that many problems. You have to get very clever. You have to give them enough problems so that they won't completely balk at them. And you have to refuse to give them so many problems that they at once stop. Do you see? So what determines it is your judgment of what is enough problem to permit them to have a solution. Enough problem to them is enough to keep them going and to reassure them that they're not going to perish for having adapted a solution. You follow me? It's a nice piece of judgment that you have to sort of work with as you're talking to any particular individual. You have to find out how much is too much problem to him by getting him to discuss points where he's kind of flubbed off, you know. How much is enough problem to him? On which dynamic is he operative? What is his acceptance level of problems? And doing that, you can feed him just enough problems in auditing individually, of course, to really bring him up to where he'll solve his case. If you don't do that, he won't solve it. So you move him over. You move him then over into the category of having enough reassurance that he'll keep on going. In other words, you give him enough survival in terms of future game in order to let him let go of some little tiny portion of the game he's playing. In other words, solve it. And therefore, in selling industry, in selling government, in selling businesses, or groups of people of a civic nature, it's necessary for you to do that. Now, in selling groups, it's much more simple than the individual. You have to be pretty good. You don't have to be as good as an individual auditor, but you have to be pretty darn good to really get in and sell a group. Walk into a civic group. You want the civic group actually to get the streets of this town clean. You want those streets clean. You're just so sick of seeing these filthy streets. Now, you could go in and tell them this, but you already know that they were organized 7 years ago to clean up the streets of the city. And they've done nothing about it. They are the total monopoly. The total monopoly on cleaning the streets of the city is vested in this organization. They are the Social Betterment League, which takes care of it. You try to organize another one, everybody will point out to you that they're wanting this. And they're not doing a thing. Why aren't they doing a thing? If they did anything, they're liable to solve it, and that would end their existence, wouldn't it? So you have to walk into that organization in this strange way. You have to say, I know you're taking care of this street cleanup sort of thing, but my God, what are you doing about the city dump? I said, the city dump? Yes, what are we doing about the city dump? See, it's outside their jurisdiction. Well, you say it's actually an old street used to go under it. And they say, good heavens! How are we going to clean up the city dump? Well, we'll have to call a special meeting. And they will. You make sure you're there. And you say, well, you know, you can solve that fairly easily, but actually getting the proper kind of steam shovel is an impossibility. They've stopped making them. But if you work very hard and send out enough people and write enough letters in enough directions, you might be able to pick up a second-hand one from the Army and the Navy. Of course, it's almost impossible to get them to give up anything. You know how cycles are. Anyhow, they just never give up. Well, what are we going to do in order to get something going? How can you start an organization moving? How can you do that? Well, you just give them more game, that's all. But that's an awfully simple statement, because like the statement of a game consists of freedom, barriers, purposes. Boy, isn't that a lovely statement? It's got onomatopoeia, euphony. It's Habardic. Doesn't mean a thing. It doesn't. Because there aren't the parts of games that work. So just saying, well, give them more game, would only work if you said it to a Scientologist who knew the parts of games. See? Give them more game. Yeah, that doesn't work. You say that to a Scientologist, you say, give them more game. He's already experienced in what game's conditions are. He knows what you mean. He turns around and says, he gives them more game. And they're willing to let go of some of the solutions. You walk into a print shop, you're trying to have some things done. And they've been holding up some little cards of yours for some time, but you have another order sitting there that they're holding up too. Determine which one you really want. You want the cards? Okay. Point out some fantastic problem with the other material, and they'll give you the cards. See, it's just a matter of more game. You got it? But what is more game? A problem is postulate counter postulate. It is itself curiosity. It's two things. It crosses there. It is a game and it's curiosity. A problem has a not no wonder about in it. And it also has two or more opposed forces. And so it's right there at a crossroads between curiosity, the CDEI circle that pins everybody to everything, and on the other side, it is a game condition. And of course, curiosity is a game condition too, but problems exemplify a game condition. Versus, versus. See, we've got two opposing forces, and a problem is John wants to go to the theater and Mary wants to stay home. It's a problem. You have to have two viewpoints in order to have a problem. You start running problems and they start getting solutions. A problem has to contain the annihilation of one of its opposing forces, one way or the other, before it solves. And if you kill one side of the counterness, you of course don't have a game anymore. See, you've got force versus force. We knock out one, there's no game. So that's a solution. A solution is a force unopposed, or a rest point achieved. And you've got to have another up here to substitute for the existing side before anybody will be willing to solve anything. So you don't sell cases on the idea of saying, George, you can get well. You say, George, you've got no idea how many real problems you have. Could it just be, George, could it just be that the problems you think have been your problems all your life aren't? Could it be that much bigger problems lurk just behind you, George, that you're not even yet able to look at? Is that it? Is that it? Guy will say, how would I find out? You say, well, 75-hour intensives, brother. Now, the funny part of it is that is a game condition which is the truth. And you have Scientology as a violation of games condition and no games condition. Scientology now finds itself in the rather silly position of knowing more about life than life does. That's very silly. Because it's perfectly true that he has more problems that he isn't yet able to face than he ever knew he had. And the problems he's fixed on are the minor problems. That's the truth. It's not the truth in industry, or otherwise most of the time, but it is the truth as far as this freeclear is concerned, and it is a games condition statement. But that's because we are auditing today in full knowledge of games condition, and we are above that level, but no other part of life is. I hope you fellas like the climb. Thank you.